Get that dog off my leg. Oh, that's better. You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper.
And I'm Pooh.
Why don't you start us off, sweetheart?
Okay. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you.
You're welcome, honey.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the paper is off the ground. It's going to be a full-blown newspaper. And I mean full size. No joke. The first issue will be out before or no later than March 1st. The name is The Intelligence Analyst. The Intelligence Analyst. If you'd like to subscribe, the subscription rate is $50 per year. And don't write me or call and ask why it's $50. And don't write and tell me or bother to call and say that the spotlight is only $38.50, because we don't care. The Intelligence Analyst is $50 per year. It will be the only, and I mean the only, objective free press in the United States of America, and maybe even the world. Everything that we report on will be documented. Nothing will be slanted to make you believe anything unless it is clearly labeled an editorial. It'll be a newspaper this nation has not seen the likes of, probably since Benjamin Franklin shut down his own press. Ladies and gentlemen, you don't want to miss it. I can tell you right now, the first issue will knock your socks off. And now, from The Secret Places of the Lion by George Hunt Williamson, London, published by Neville Spearman, 1958. I'm going to quote. And then tonight, I'm going to read to you some more from the law, from treaties, from Supreme Court decisions. You don't want to miss it. But from The Secret Places of the Lion, I quote, "The mystery will be completely revealed when the earth will be rent by earthquakes and the secret places of the lion are secret no more. The mystery of mysteries will be revealed at the sounding of the great trumpet. The earth will reap its reward because through countless ages the thoughts of evil men have created a vibration that must find expression now on a physical plane. The thoughts of those in the light have created a frequency that will literally open the secret chambers and temples of remote antiquity. As the vibrations sealed and protected the tombs, they can also open the tombs in the fullness of time. For there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed, and hid that shall not be known." Matthew chapter 10, verse 26. "And there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great." Revelation chapter 16, verse 18. Nostradamus predicted a great earthquake that would reveal St. Peter's tomb and destroy the Vatican. "That which was discovered and called the tomb of Simon Peter is not the true sepulcher of the apostle. The seven hills of Rome will be torn asunder, and tombs and truths, even as Joseph's tomb in Egypt was exposed on the night of the final Exodus, will be revealed to a world bathed in the new vibrational radiance of the golden dawn. He that hath an ear, let him hear. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the hidden manna, and will give him a white stone, and in the stone a new name written, which no man knoweth, saving he that receiveth it." Revelation chapter 2, verse 17. "The harvest gathered by the angel messengers will be small. They will eat of the hidden manna. They will be given a white stone. In that stone there will be a new name written. The hidden manna is the frequency of the golden dawn. The white stone is a purified planet. The new name is an entity lifted into another dimension of time and space. When the secret places of the lion open to man, he will find himself in the secret places of the thunder, and the ancient knowledge of the secret places of the stairs will be his once again after millions of years of seeking. The earth will shake and tremble. The foundations of the hills will move and be shaken. The heavens will proclaim the newness and everlasting oneness of all things. All this shall come to pass in this generation until the time of final discovery. The truth of the greater light is like a lion greedy of its prey, as it were a young lion lurking in secret places. One great cycle of time is now ending. Shortly, a new cycle begins. The Christ or Christos knocks on the door of the heart of the world. Those that bid him enter shall be the children of the new covenant. Welcome to the New World Order. Read Foreign Relations, April 1974. The article, Hard Road to World Order. It is the blueprint of the destruction of the sovereignty of the United States of America. Title 22, Foreign Relations and Intercourse, page 652. Under definitions, as used in this chapter, the terms arms control and disarmament mean the identification, verification, inspection, limitation, control, reduction, or elimination of armed forces and armaments of all kinds under international agreement, including the necessary steps taken under such an agreement to establish an effective system of international control, or to create and strengthen international organizations for the maintenance of peace. Subchapter 2, Organization, United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. There is established an agency to be known as the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, and very, very, very many paragraphs and pages later, under amendments. You see, Americans raised a hue and cry upon reading that definition, because it literally means all arms of all kinds. They raised such a hue and cry that Congress was forced to pass an amendment in 1963. Public Law 88-186 inserted provision precluding construction of this chapter to authorize the regulation of the possession of firearms by an individual. But, ladies and gentlemen, that was a scam. for Executive Order Number 11044, Interagency Coordination, September 9, 1987, further elaborated and changed this law. And, folks, under paragraph C of Section 1 of that executive order, the terms arms control and disarmament shall be defined as they are defined in Section 3A of the Arms Control and Disarmament Act, Section 255-2A of this title. And let me read to you exactly what that says. It says, ladies and gentlemen, the terms arms control and disarmament mean the identification, verification, inspection, limitation, control, reduction, or elimination of armed forces and armaments of all kinds under international agreement, including the necessary steps taken under such an agreement to establish an effective system of international control, or to create and strengthen international organizations for the maintenance of peace, thus doing away, ladies and gentlemen, doing away with the amendment in 1963 under Public Law 88-186, by changing the definition back to what it originally was. You see how very easy it is to make a law. The public raise a hue and cry. They change the law to conform with the desires of the public. And then, at some short time later, merely insert a small paragraph, putting it all back the way it was before. Title 22, Foreign Relations and Intercourse, page 664, under Amendments, subsection A, Public Law 100-213, amended, generally substituting provisions authorizing appropriations to carry out this chapter for fiscal years, blankety blank blank. And then down in 1977, subsection A, Public Law 95-108, further changes it. And then in 1975, subsection A, Public Law 94-141, section 141. And then a killer. Subsection D, Public Law 94-141, subsection 148, struck out subsection D relating to prohibition of using appropriated funds for the dissemination of propaganda within the United States concerning the work of the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. Ain't this fun? Now here we have United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, Washington, D.C., December 14, 1992. Public Law 102-228, December 12, 1991. Dear Mr. President, well, let me start on the other side. The Inspector General of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, ACDA, was assisted in considering Executive Branch Organization for Arms Control and in reviewing ACDA's performance by a panel of present and former arms control practitioners and Office of Inspector General Inspection staff members who prepared this report. Dear Mr. President, I am pleased to submit to you the report reviewing ACDA and the arms control function in the executive branch mandated by Public Law 102-228 of December 1991. As directed in the legislation, I am also submitting the report to the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the Chairman of the Committee on Foreign Relations of the Senate. To assist me in conducting this review of ACDA's performance and Executive Branch Organization for Arms Control, I appointed a panel under the leadership of retired Ambassador James E. Goodbye, appropriate name, Goodbye USA. I charged the panel to consider the impact on arms control of the main international security issues facing the nation now and in the future. Arms control remains of critical importance to United States security, but it has been transformed in the wake of the Cold War, and there is a new priority, arms control agenda. Among a wide range of organizational concepts for dealing with arms control, new agenda, two are judged most likely to promote U.S. national interests and to meet the challenges of our changed world. To revitalize ACDA and continue it as a separate entity are to fold it into the Department of State. A separate agency is the better solution in order to provide a continuing resource for technical analysis and support in the arms control field. To be an advocate for arms control solutions, to foster innovation, and to serve as a watchdog on issues of arms control implementation and non-proliferation. We believe that all of these objectives can be achieved more efficiently and effectively by a separate independent agency. The report notes that ACDA's independent status has enabled it to force discussion of issues on which other agencies held opposing views. Similar situations inevitably will rise again. The President, White House, Washington, D.C. Regional conflicts are seen by the State Department's regional bureaus as their natural preserve. ACDA has been most influential in efforts to resolve regional conflicts. When the director devotes time and energy to the problem, or when ACDA's technical expertise is relevant. As one ACDA official observed, arms control techniques cannot resolve or diffuse a regional dispute that the political process is not ready for. Nevertheless, ACDA can contribute arms control techniques to supplement other efforts to promote regional settlements. ACDA has been heavily involved, from the director downward, in recent efforts to stop the North Korean nuclear weapons program. The ACDA contributed to the success this effort has enjoyed so far is widely acknowledged. ACDA participation in the interagency task force that coordinated policy during and after the Persian Gulf War was limited to providing one full-time officer who did, however, play a significant role in the task force activities serving as the unofficial deputy to the director. In the implementation of the President's Middle East Arms Control Initiative of May 27, 1991, however, ACDA has made valuable contributions. It has actively participated in the group charged with classifying weapons that would be subject to restraints in exports to the Middle East and voluntarily produced a study of the relevant laws of the five major exporters of conventional weapons to the area. The five permanent members of the UN Security Council, identifying the areas in which harmonization would be desirable, it also contributed to the recent Arab-Israeli seminar. And it talks about the revitalization of the Arms Control and Disarmament Act, and it gives a list of names. The following were contacted during the review. And ladies and gentlemen, the names that are in this list are amazing. People have been lying to you for many years about their agendas, about their political belief, about their stance on arms control, and many, many other issues. Here we are. Let's look at Congress. Senators Honorable John Glenn, Honorable Carl Levine, Richard Lugar, Sam Nunn, Claiborne Pell, or Claiborne Pell, Paul Simon, Dante Fassell, Porter Goss, Lee Hamilton, John Kyle, and congressional staff members, Senator Biden, Jamie Rubin, Senator Glenn, Leonard Weiss, and Randy Rydell, Senator Gore, Leon Furth, Senator Levin, Richard Fieldhouse, Senator Lugar, Ken Myers, Senator Pell, William Ashworth, Senator Roth, Ian Butterfield, Senator Simon, Jonathan Stein, Senator Wallop, Eric Thoms, Senate Armed Services Committee, Robert Bell, Senate Foreign Relations Committee, David Sullivan, Congressman Kyle, David Smith, Congressman Solars, Stanley Roth, House Foreign Affairs Committee, Ivo Spalatin, House Foreign Affairs Committee, Walker Roberts, House Foreign Affairs Committee, Janie Hatcher, House Foreign Affairs Committee, David Barton, Office of Technology Assessment, Gerald Epstein, and I can go on and on and on. Government-funded research institutions and laboratories, RAND, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, Los Alamos National Laboratory, Arvid Lundy, American Enterprise Institute, Brookings Institution, Dr. Lawrence Korb, Brookings Institution Ambassador Retired Raymond L. Garthoff, Brookings Institution Jan Nolan, Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, they're not involved in anything. There's probably no such organization. Just a bunch of old men that sit around and tell stories. Yes. I'm the only one gifted by God to tell you what to think on the EIB network. Council on Foreign Relations. Conspiracy freaks! Conspiracy freaks! Committee for National Security, Georgetown University. Georgetown University again. Georgetown University again. All listing people, prominent professors there. University of Maryland. University of Maryland again. University of Maryland again. George Quester. University of Maryland again. Adam Yarmolinsky. Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Stanford University. Now, the universities aren't involved in all of this decision-making. No, sir. They wouldn't take your guns away, would they? Arms Control Association, Spurgeon M. Keeney, Jr., Jack Mendelson, and guess what, folks? The Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation. Kim Holmes, Baker Spring, John Getty, James Phillips, the Union of Concerned Scientists, Ambassador Retired Jonathan Dean, Washington Quarterly, Brad Roberts, Woodrow Wilson Center, Jenone Walker, President, Carnegie Foundation, Ambassador Retired Morton Abramowitz, President Henry L. Stimson Center, Michael Crepon, Assistant Director, Henry L. Stimson Center, Amy Smithson, Director, International Institute for Strategic Studies, London, Francois Heisborg. So here we got the United States consulting the director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, a Mr. Francois Heisborg, who's French. Oh, I love it. Private sector, FAIC and former SEC commissioner and ACDA official Sidney Graybeal. FAIC and former state and ACDA official Lewis Dunn. Meridian Corporation and former state and ACDA official Lois Nozenzo. Ogden Environmental Services and former ACDA official Charles Van Doren. Isn't he the guy that got kicked off of the $64,000 question for cheating? Schloss Associates and former state and ACDA official Leon Schloss. Lawyer and former SALT I delegation legal advisor John Rhinelander, Esquire. President BDM Corporation and former National Security Council staff Philip Odine. And many more. In fact, maybe I'll just read you all of these names. Why not? We've got the time. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, Ronald F. Lehman II. Deputy Director, Stephen R. Hanmer, Jr. Office of Security, James Lannan. Office of Administration, Kathleen Lawrence. Executive Secretary, Barbara Starr. U.S. Commissioner, SCC and BCC, Ambassador Robert Joseph. United States Representative, SVC and JCIC, Ambassador Stephen Steiner. Counselor and Congressional Affairs, Ambassador Richard Hallwill. Policy Planning Group, Michelle Markoff, Director. Senior Military Advisor, Colonel Donald Sellers, United States Air Force. Chief Science Advisor, Nancy Dowdy. Office of General Counsel, Thomas Graham Jr. General Counsel, Mary Elizabeth Hoinks, Deputy. Office of Public Affairs, Sharon Basso, Acting Director. Bureau of Multilateral Affairs, Michael Moody, Assistant Director. David Clinard, Principal Deputy Assistant Director. Donald Molly, Deputy Assistant Director. Bureau of Nonproliferation Policy, Bradley Gordon, Assistant Director. Norman Wolf, Principal Deputy Assistant Director. Vincent Duquesne, Deputy Assistant Director. Bureau of Strategic and Nuclear Affairs, Lucas Fisher, Acting Assistant Director. Bureau of Verification and Implementation, Fred Eimer, Assistant Director. Edward Lacey, Deputy Assistant Director. Central Intelligence Agency, Robert M. Gates, Director, Chairman, National Intelligence Council, Fritz Ermer, Director, Arms Control Intelligence Staff, Douglas MacEachin, Director, Non-Proliferation Center, Gordon Oler, Chief Treaty Monitoring Center, James Peake, from the Defense Intelligence Agency. Panel members also talked with 12 other CIA personnel. Department of Commerce, Assistant Secretary for Export Administration, Acting James Lee Munyon. Director of Foreign Policy, Office of Technology and Policy Analysis, David Schlechte. Department of Defense, Undersecretary of Policy, Paul Wolfowitz. Assistant Secretary for International Security Policy, Stephen Hadley. OSDISP, Deputy Assistant Secretary, Frank Miller. OSDISP, Deputy Assistant Secretary, Douglas Graham. Deputy Assistant Secretary, William Ingley. Assistant to the Secretary of Defense, Atomic Energy, John Barrilly. Assistant to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lieutenant General Barry R. McCaffrey, United States Army. Director, Defense Intelligence Agency, Lieutenant General James R. Clapper, USAF. Maybe we can turn it off. Come on, Clapper, work. It's not working. Got to call technical, what do you call it? Technical help there? Yeah. Get that number, would you please? Joint Chiefs of Staff, J5, Deputy Director, International Negotiations, Major General Gary Curtin, United States Air Force. Panel members also talked with 14 other Department of Defense personnel. On-site inspection agency. You didn't even know there was such a thing, did you? On-site inspection agency. Believe me, the Russians have their people here from their on-site inspection agency also. Director, Major General Robert Parker, United States Air Force. Principal Deputy Director, Jorg Minzel, Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. Deputy Director, Edward M. Ift, Department of State. Director, Office of Arms Control and Non-Proliferation, Victor Alessi. Director, Office of Public Affairs, Barry Daniels. National Security Council Staff, Defense Policy and Arms Control, Brigadier General John Gordon, United States Air Force. Susan Koch, Craig Chellis, Richard Davis, Daniel Poneman, Will Toby, International Economic Affairs, Richard Barr, Legal Advisor, Nicholas Rostow, Secretary James A. Baker III, Department of State, Deputy Secretary Lawrence S. Eagleburger, Undersecretary for Political Affairs, Arnold Cantor, Undersecretary for International Security Affairs, Reginald Bartholomew, Undersecretary for International Security Affairs, Frank Wisner, Ambassador-at-Large, Richard Kennedy, Head of Delegation to the Negotiations on Nuclear and Space Arms. Space Arms? Space Arms? Ambassador Linton Brooks, Advisor for Strategic Policy, James Timby, Senior Representative for Strategic Technology Policy, Ambassador Alan Wendt. I wish he had went a long time ago. Policy Planning Staff, Robert Einhorn, Assistant Secretary for European and Canadian Affairs, Thomas M. T. Niles, Assistant Secretary for Political Military Affairs, Richard Clark, Assistant Secretary for Political Military Affairs, Robert Gallucci, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Political Military Affairs, Mark Grossman, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Political Military Affairs, Robert Walpole, Assistant Secretary for International Organization Affairs, John Bolton, Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy and Energy Technology Affairs, Fred McGoldrick, Deputy to the Coordinator for United States Assistance to the New Independent States, Ambassador Richard Armitage.
Lay out a few more lines there, Georgie. See if Gritz wants some. Oh, that's right. I forgot he ratted on us. Don't give him any.
United States Information Agency, U.S. Delegation, U.S. Representative Ambassador Stephen Ledegar, Deputy U.S. Representative Lyle Brecken, Executive Secretary John King, Senior Department of State Representative Robert Dubois, Senior Office of the Secretary of Defense Representative Ron Nelson, Senior Department of Energy Representative Thomas D. Agostino, Senior Joint Chiefs of Staff Representative Colonel David Lambert, United States Army, CD Secretary General Ambassador Vincente Barasetegui, Australian Representative. Ambassador Gerard Herrera, with French Deputy Representative, Japanese Representative Ambassador Tanaka, Netherlands Representative Ambassador Hendrik Wagenmakers, Russian Representative Ambassador Sergei Batsanov, Swedish Representative Ambassador Carl Magnus Hyltenius, United Kingdom Deputy Representative Ian Kenyon, Deputy Chief of Mission, U.S. Mission to the United Nations Organizations in Geneva, H. Clark Rogers, and in Vienna, and London, and United Nations, and on and on and on and on and on. Former officials, Honorable William F. Burns, Major General, United States Army, retired, Honorable Ralph Earl II, Honorable Fred Ilkel, Honorable George M. Senius II, Honorable Gerard C. Smith, Honorable Paul C. Warnke. Many of these names are famous. Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Negotiator, Honorable Paul H. Nitze. Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Negotiator, Honorable Maynard W. Glickman. Head of Delegation to the Negotiations on Nuclear on Space Arms, UND Space Arms, Honorable Max Campbellman. Head of Delegation to the Negotiations on Nuclear and Space Arms, Honorable Richard R. Burt. Conventional Armed Forces in Europe Negotiator, Honorable R. James Woolsey. Secretary of Defense, Honorable Donald Rumsfeld. Secretary of Defense, Honorable Frank Carlucci. Ooh, there's a famous one. Director of Central Intelligence, Honorable William Colby. Director of Central Intelligence, Honorable Richard M. Helms. Both extremely shady characters, the likes of Al Capone. Under Secretary of State for Security Assistance, Matthew Nimitz, Esquire. Deputy Under Secretary of Defense for Policy, Walter Slocum, Esquire. Deputy Director, Office of Science and Technology Policy and National Security Council Staff, Benjamin Huberman. And folks, these are just the ones on the record. You see, they couldn't pass all these bills through Congress if they weren't all involved in this. Do you understand what I'm telling you? Don't go away. Don't go away. I might be back. Folks, the Hour of the Times brought to you by Swiss American Trading, our good friends down there that take such good care of you. In fact, I had a notice on the BBS tonight from one of our listeners who didn't have a lot of money and wanted to take care of their economic situation.
called Gene Miller, and by golly, they didn't think they were going to be able to do anything, but Gene worked with them and helped them, and they were very, very happy with the results. And if you have doubts, call Gene Miller or anybody else down at Swiss America Trading. Just talk to them. They'll help you. That's their job. And they promised me to give you red carpet treatment and help you in any way that they can. And they've never failed to do that yet, folks. Never. Not once. You need some real money. Real money. In the United States Code, it specifically says that the money of the United States of America is gold and silver coin. Gold and silver coin. It says the measurement of the money shall be expressed in dollars, which shall indicate a specific weight of gold and silver coin. The Constitution of the United States of America states emphatically, and it's never been amended, no state shall tender payment in debt anything other than gold or silver coin. What's that thing in your pocket? Have you ever looked up the definition of a note under the law in the legal dictionary? Do you know what it says? Do you know that currency that takes the place of money must be redeemable in the money that it represents? Have you ever tried to redeem money with Federal Reserve notes? Do you really understand how you've been lied to and deceived? Have you really got a grasp on what's happening? Do you know that a note is an instrument of debt, which if used long enough by enough people will result, ladies and gentlemen, in the turnover of all your assets to those who hold the notes? Were you aware of that? Do you even care? If you do care, and if you are aware, folks, do something about it. Get some real money and do it quick. 1-800-289-2646. 1-800-289-2646. Do it now before it's too late. Sure, where are you when we need you now? Oh, for a good old 1955 Chevrolet and a roadmap of Route 66. We wouldn't have to worry about any of this, would we? This, ladies and gentlemen, is from the United States Department of State Dispatch Bureau of Public Affairs, November 15th, 1993, Volume 4, Number 46. Let me read you some of these titles here. NAFTA in the Overriding Interest of the United States by Secretary Christopher. NAFTA implementing legislation and related documents by President Clinton. Building a consensus on international peacekeeping by Madeleine K. Albright. Open Skies Treaty ratified. Open Skies Treaty? What's that? Then they got treaty actions and new ambassadors. Don't bust a gut there, Bart. Don't fall off that stool, okay? Open Skies Treaty ratified. You've heard me say before, ladies and gentlemen, that in the ratification of the Disarmament Act and in the all of the amendments and everything to it, they've established a method to ratify the disarmament of the countries involved, which is all. So they ratified the Open Skies Treaty. This statement was released by the White House Press Secretary, Washington, D.C., November 3, 1993. Listen to this. The President has signed the United States Instrument of Ratification of the Treaty on Open Skies. This multilateral aerial observation regime represents the broadest and most flexible effort to date to promote openness and transparency of military forces and activities. Do you know what that means? It means every day, Russian planes fly across the United States. Yes, they do. With intelligence gathering equipment, including cameras, eavesdropping equipment, reconnaissance equipment, and they photograph the entire United States of America, including all of our military installations. They photograph the destruction of our B-52 bombers in the desert that are being chopped apart with huge guillotines. And every day, so many of them have to be destroyed. And if they're not, the Russians bring it up at the next disarmament meeting and say, why not? Did you know that? This treaty responds to the new demands of the post-Cold War world and the desire of many states to find innovating means of strengthening confidence and predictability. It will give all participants an agreed way to obtain information about foreign military forces and activities of concern to them. Notice they didn't say anything about foreign military forces getting access to our military deployment and facilities, did they? Under the treaty, each participating state may conduct a certain number of unarmed flights anywhere over the territory of the other participants using approved observation techniques. The data collected during these flights will be available to all participants. This combination of breadth of coverage, flexibility of use, and availability of information enables the Open Skies regime to make a unique contribution to building confidence and enhancing stability. Does it make you feel safer? Present signatories include all NATO allies, the East European members of the former Warsaw Pact, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, Georgia, and Kyrgyzstan or something. I can't even pronounce this word. K-Y-R-G-Y-Z-S-T-A-N. I bet you can't either. The states of the former Soviet Union and all CSCE states are eligible to join on an accelerated basis. The treaty is open to any nation by consensus approval. The model developed in the treaty could also be important to the reduction of local tensions and the prevention of conflict in regions beyond the scope of current signatories. The Open Skies concept was first put forward by President Eisenhower in 1955. You see, that's how long this has been going on, folks. Even longer. Much, much longer. You haven't even got a clue. And then revived by treaty proposed by President George Bush in 1989. It was signed on March 24, 1992, and received the unanimous advice and consent of the United States Senate on August 6, 1993. Ratification in several countries has been completed and in others is underway. The United States looks forward to ratification soon by all signatories and the treaty's early entry into force. You understand what that means? And from the intelligence and security implications of the Treaty on Open Skies, report of the Select Committee on Intelligence, United States Senate, May 19th, 1993. This is Senate Report 103-44. On page 7. One area in which a decision mechanism is not specified is what to do if representatives of the observed party believe that the observing party has used a sensor improperly. The observed party controls both the airspace and the ground, so it can always bring force to bear. But no means short of that is set forth for preventing the observing party from leaving the country with improperly gathered data. So any dispute in this area could well escalate to this level and become at least a minor diplomatic incident. Nevertheless, what they got
And the chief U.S. representative to the Open Skies negotiations testified to the committee that the United States does not expect to be the primary direct beneficiary. Do you understand? We're not going to benefit from this. The Russians will. So will all the other countries who are allowed to overfly and photograph all of our military missile and strategic installations, railroad lines, highways, cities, anything of military importance that could be classified as armament are promoting for the delivery or transfer of armament from place to place. Does not expect the United States to be the primary direct beneficiary. In terms of information gains, of the openness that the treaty will provide. Rather, he stated, the greatest information gains resulting from the treaty will go to the great majority of participants other than the United States. How about that, folks? Potential future value. Open skies may have the most benefits for non-time-sensitive issues where research based on bonus coverage is useful. According to the testimony of executive branch officials, the greatest informational benefits to the United States from the Open Skies Treaty may rest in future environmental sensing packages, either under this treaty or pursuant to a future agreement. Environmentally monitoring could provide the model for a future global airborne environmental monitoring regime. Global change research. Listen to this. Man-made disasters. What does that mean? Even the observation that is permitted under the Open Skies Treaty could result in the compromise of sensitive information, aerial observation of military movements or exercises, industrial plant configurations or activities, and outdoor testing, deployment, or storage of equipment could give foreign countries direct or indirect insight into United States military capabilities and readiness beyond that which the U.S. government is prepared to disclose for the purpose of confidence building. It is also conceivable, although perhaps not likely, given the low resolution of open sky sensors, that proprietary industrial information could be compromised. How is anybody going to know what level of observation the sensors can make when the plane is way up in the sky, folks? This is ridiculous. It's dumb. And we're in it. Territory. The first requirement for a realistic open skies regime was that all states parties agreed to make their entire territory accessible to aerial observation. This was also the most difficult question to resolve, given the long tradition of keeping certain areas closed in the former Soviet Union. It has now been agreed and specified in the treaty that all territory is open to observation, and that states parties may not restrict observation flights for national security reasons. Let me say that again, just in case you've got wax in your ears. All territory is open to observation, and that states parties may not restrict observation flights for national security reasons. Parties may restrict an observation flight only for legitimate reasons of flight safety. They don't want the spies to get hurt. Quotas. Observation under open skies will not be subject to refusal. Will not be subject to refusal. All parties to the treaty are assigned passive quotas, specifying the number of flights they must accept from other participants in a year. Further parties are assigned active quotas, specifying how many observation flights they may undertake and which countries they may observe. The determination of the passive and active quotas of the participants was a sensitive subject in the negotiations. I'll bet it was. Under the Open Skies Treaty, the United States will have a passive quota of 42 flights annually. In effect, it will be obligated to accept up to 42 flights from other participating states if requested. The United States originally said it could accept 52 flights annually or one flight per week. That number was lowered in the course of the negotiations so that the U.S. number would not exceed the number for Belarus, Russia, also 42. For the first 3 years after entry into force, countries will only have to accept up to 75% of their passive quotas, meaning that the initial United States passive obligation is 31. For the first year of the treaty's operation, only 4 of these 31 potential flights over the United States were requested, all by Belarus, Russia. Well, who did you think was going to request it? Who else cares? Who else has the capability to attack us? Why would they want to know? Which are operating as a group of states parties under the provisions of the treaty as a group. Belarus, Russia will have a joint quota and will conduct observation flights jointly and receive flights jointly, which may go to any portion of their combined territory. No other participating state expressed interest in observing the United States. Sensors. Aircraft may be equipped with video cameras and panoramic and framing cameras for daylight photography. Infrared line scanning systems, which can operate by day and night, and synthetic aperture radar, which can operate day and night in any weather. The quality of pictures produced by the cameras on an observation aircraft is designed to make it possible to recognize major items of military equipment. For example, to distinguish between a tank and a truck. States parties may consider additional categories of sensors during periodic meetings of the Open Skies Consultative Commission to ensure the fullest possible participation in open skies, including participation by states lacking appropriate sensor technology. Listen to this. The treaty provides that sensors which are used must be commercially available to all states parties to the treaty. So if we're going to use a specific sensor to overfly another country, such as Russia, we must make that same equipment commercially available to Russia and any other state party to the treaty. From the Tampa Tribune, Tampa, Florida, Saturday, April 8, 1994. Military bases face heavy cuts. The list of future closings next year is expected to nearly equal the total number of 3 previous rounds. April 9, 1994, by John Diamond of the Associated Press, Washington. The Clinton administration is preparing to lower the boom on the nation's military bases with a proposed list of closures next year that could nearly match all the base closures ordered since 1988. And it goes over here. Though through the end of the century and beyond, the cost of shutting down bases is expected to outweigh the savings realized. And then Defense Base Closure and Realignment Commission for the 1995 round of closures. It is important that we use the last round of closures to align our base structure more closely with our future mission needs. What future mission? She said Pentagon officials expect a sizable proposal for closures and realignments. What realignments? Says there's not enough money in the entire defense budget to clean up the bases we're closing, Hansen said. At Pease Air Force Base in New Hampshire, the first base ordered closed. An initial environmental cleanup estimated of $11 million was revised upward over 3 years to $114 million just to clean up one closed base. The Clinton administration is seeking $1.8 billion for base closing and, here's that mysterious word again, realignment. What is the realignment? Folks, many of these bases are not being closed at all. It's a scam. It is a lie. They're being converted to prisons. If you don't believe me, call your congressman and ask him. Come together to stop the spread of weapons and violence in our communities and around the world. International Citizens Assembly to Stop the Spread of Weapons, New York City, April 19th through the 24th, 1995. We seek to build a movement embracing all cultures, races, and nations. This requires peace with social, economic, and environmental justice. It means opposing all weapons of destruction, from nuclear and conventional arms used between nations to handguns and assault weapons used between neighbors. The spread of weapons, large and small, stimulates violence and wastes money and human resources, which should instead be used to meet basic human rights and needs. Did you know, ladies and gentlemen, that on the grounds of the United Nations in New York,
a foreign country, has erected a sculpture of a Smith and Wesson revolver with its barrel tied in a knot. Now, why did they put it on the grounds of the United Nations in the United States of America in New York? Why didn't they put the statue up in their own country, on their own land, on their own property, in their own city? Anybody know the answer to that? Anybody at all? And, by golly, here's the Tokyo 1991, the annual meeting of the Trilateral Commission.
Trilateral Commission? There's no such thing. No, that's those conspiracy nuts again, and we're not taking any calls from those people. For I, God's gift to the world, am sitting on half my brain. And the other half is safely tucked away in a safety deposit box in Citibank, in the Kremlin branch. Only I am gifted by God to tell you how to think and call the president names for 3 hours every day. So don't listen to these conspiracy freaks who tell you that the Trilateral Commission even exists, because it doesn't even exist and they're not involved in anything, even if they were, and the Rockefellers don't have anything to do with it. Quoting, ladies and gentlemen, from Tokyo, 1991, the annual meeting of the Trilateral Commission. Trilogue 43, the Trilateral Commission was formed in 1973 by private citizens of Western Europe, Japan, and North America to foster closer cooperation among these three regions on common problems. It seeks to improve public understanding of such problems, to support proposals for handling them jointly, and to nurture habits and practices of working together among these regions. The chairman of North America is David Rockefeller. David Rockefeller. Under the table of contents, Japanese developments and their international implications, Asia-Pacific regional developments in a global context. Section 3, future of the international economic order. Section 4, the Gulf Crisis. What peace after war? All through here are the terms New World Order, New World Economic Order, Global Cooperation. International peacekeeping under the United Nations. They have a list of reports and books and publications, global cooperation after the Cold War, etc., 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 etc. Good night. God bless you all. Please wake up. God save this republic.